Welcome, everyone, joining us here tonight on the Kings County Radio Club's Technical Question and Answer Net. My name is Roy. My call sign is AC2GS, and I will be your net control operator for this informal net. I will be your host, and Bob KD2NVB will be my co-host on this exploration into amateur radio technology. The purpose of this net is to provide a platform for discussion and to offer our answers, as well as to promote a conversation among all participants of this net. The club maintains an archive of these technical nets on its web pages, and we also offer original articles and reviews on many topics that are covered during these technical nets. We also publish technical puzzles for our participants to ponder, and as a starting off point to discuss important technical concepts. Tonight's TechNet puzzle is posted on our club's website. The link can be found on the front page of our website in orange colored type, but if you would like to have a simple URL to find it, just type into your browser puzzle.kc2rc.com, and that should find the page. Also, we will be offering a streaming service for those who cannot receive our repeater signal. Just point your browser to stream.kc2rc.com, and we also have a Echo Link node available for use. Just point your Echo Link application to the node kc2rc-r. This net is scheduled for the second and fourth Wednesday of every month. All of this information can also be found on our club's website, which is www.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. As always, an application is readily available on our club's website. No question is too simple. No question is dumb. All wisdom begins with the asking of questions. If you have a question, it deserves to be answered. Our format tonight will be to ask for participants to check in only if they have questions or comments for this net. Please give us your first name, your call sign, whether you have a question or a comment. The net will then address each question in order. I will try to provide a cogent answer, and Bob KD2NBB will join in as well. If any other listener has any further facts or opinions, they will be free to break in with the word comment, and when recognized, offer their knowledge or experiences to us all. If anyone has any suggestions for future topics of interest, please let us know either here on the TechNet or use our email address, tech@kc2rc.com. And now I would like to introduce my co-host for this net, Bob KD2NVB. Good evening, Bob.
Good evening, Roy. Good evening, everybody out there. Looking forward to an interesting TechNet tonight. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, very good, Bob. I did a little bit of tweaking to the system. I'm curious if you perceive my audio as being a wee bit stronger today.
Yeah, it is. And so maybe a little less stuff that I always thought was just the repeater, but a little less, not even static, but not even to that level, but there's less of it now. There's a little bit of a hum, but that's always there. It's from the repeater, I think.
Yeah, unfortunately, yeah, when I hear you, I hear it with a hum as well. It sounds, I can't quite figure if it's 60. I think it's 60. It might be 120 because my ears aren't that great, but it sounds like something has introduced a ground loop hum into it. So we got a little bit of a 60 cycle hum going on at the repeater.
60. It's in that octave.
Yeah, it's a very common problem with electrical equipment. You inevitably have a bunch of things connected to a bunch of other things, and somewhere you get a ground loop, and then you got this 60-cycle electrical supply in 60-cycle hum is kind of, you know, a very common one. You know, maybe someday if someone ever gets to the repeater, they can kind of check the connections and see if that could be ameliorated. We'll talk about it. We'll have to see. Anyway, good to have you, Bob. I hope we have some other people. I see on the Echo Link that William is linked in, so that's good. I hope we have other people as well. Hope we have a lively night. So let's begin. This is AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. If anyone has any questions or comments for tonight's net, please hit that push to talk and give me your call sign, your first name, and if it's a question or a comment, and we'll make a list if we get enough people, and we'll see how things go. So let us begin. Gosh, this may be one of our shorter episodes. I don't know if anyone took in the announcements from Amazon. They pretty much used the opportunity to announce that they were going to, surprise, surprise, add some artificial intelligence to their Alexa software that runs on their Echo speakers, and they license out the technology. So unfortunately, when I said her name, she responded. Anyway, so apparently in March, they'll be rolling it out initially to their high-end Echo speakers. Hopefully, eventually, they'll roll it out to my Sonos speakers that also use that technology, and I'll be able to see how clever she is. Anyway, anyone with any comments or questions or topics for tonight, please hit that push to talk. Yeah, all I got was the EV. You got to give the repeater a second or two to kind of get ready to transmit. You can't just push the button, push the talk, and just talk, unfortunately. Nothing is instantaneous in this world.
Roy, this is AC2ZB checking in for the TechNet.
Okay, very good, William. You know, like I said, unfortunately, sometimes if you hit the push to talk and you don't let the repeater kind of, you know, figure it all out for a second or two, it just, all that I hear is the last second of your transmission. The first few seconds are lost while the repeater gets ready to transmit.
I'll keep that in mind. Okay, well, anyway, I just was letting you know that I was originally listening to you on Echolink. And there was actually no hum on Echolink, and you were loud and clear. And then when you talked, after you talked to Bob, I heard Bob with the hum that you guys were talking about. And then after you had that little conversation, and I think you were calling for people to come in and join the TechNet, what happened was all of a sudden the Echolink would drop out, and it would, like, you know, I'd get like a part of a cylinder. I mean, and you can't make out what's going on because the audio just drops out, you know, while talking. So, I don't know, you changed some settings, but it seemed like Echolink was better, and then it had dropout. So I'm going to monitor that for a while longer, and I hope other people would come and check into the net. I do have a technical question, but let's see if anybody else has a question out there.
Okay. Well, I tweaked up the delay a little bit longer, so I'll have a little bit more of a squelch tail. Hopefully that will lessen the chance of dropout. We'll have to see. Anyway, once again, this is AC2GS and the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We're open for business. If anyone out there has any questions, please hit that push to talk and give us your call sign and get your name on the list. Well, William, maybe a little bit later we'll get some more people, but I think there's lots of time for your question right now. Well, once again, William, I don't think there's that many people listening to us right now. Hopefully, as the night progresses, people will show up a little late. So if you have a question, feel free.
I was wondering about hearing aids and stuff like that. And, you know, recently there's been a lot of discussion in my group about hearing aids, a new hearing aid company, and how it has all these different adaptive bands. And I'm just wondering what ham radio operators do that need hearing aids, and how that's got to be a situation that's running around in the ham community, and people must have ways of dealing with it. So I'm wondering if you have any comments about that.
Yeah, not surprisingly, because of the general demographics of our hobby, there's a lot of guys who are using hearing aids, both on the air and off the air. One of the guys I knew a great deal, who fortunately, you know, became a silent key a couple of years ago, Eric, KE2EJ, was a television engineer, and he had hearing aids on. So I don't think there's anything particularly different or special. I think for the most part, the hams will wear their hearing aids when they're on the air, because hearing aids are, I think, a much more sophisticated device to contour audio than anything that radio designers have built into the receiver circuits. You know, receiver circuits have equalizers and noise limiters and noise blankers, but you know, the sophistication of the average hearing aid, you know, those things, the high-end ones, cost thousands of dollars. So the amateur radio companies couldn't afford to have expensive circuits like that into every radio for, you know, the, say, 2-3% of people who need some kind of assistance with their hearing levels. But I don't know. I mean, did you have any idea of how else hams handle it?
Well, I don't know. I was thinking that maybe there would be some kind of a Bluetooth hookup from your radio, and there's no new sophisticated control panel, because I understand that what's happening is that apparently they say they can tune up your earbuds, and with a multi-band system, the way that the earbuds currently work right now, and that works as a hearing aid for people who are slightly hearing impaired but not needing the full magilla of the AI audio improvement. But anyway, it seemed like there might be stuff out there on the horizon. I don't look into it, but, you know, you're in the know, so I'm thinking, hey, maybe this stuff is out there and people are actually having Bluetooth connections to their radio, because that would be the most common, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you could do it that way, but again, I think that, you know, having a connection by either Bluetooth or just through the loudspeakers or headsets wouldn't really produce that much of a difference in the sound contours and such. Now, when you talk about Apple Pro 2, I think, it now has applications that it can be a kind of poor man's sort of hearing aid. Even Apple doesn't kind of suggest that this is the kind of ultimate technology for hearing aids. It probably can do some of the work of some of the less expensive, you know, less than $1,000 models. Matter of fact, I have a Pro 2, and just out of sheer curiosity, I ran the software, and it asked me, of course, to indicate when I heard sounds coming out of my AirPod Pro. You know, they would shift frequencies, and I would tap when I hear it, and thankfully, according to the software, I don't have any particular hearing loss for my age, so it didn't suggest any adjustment or use of the Air Pro 2 as a hearing aid. But again, it's sort of a somewhat poor man's hearing aid. It's not as quite as sophisticated as the state-of-the-art professional ones that you tend to need to get under the care of an audiologist to properly adjust the complex settings that are available.
Do you know how that's actually done, these complex settings? Because the most I ever got from the audiologist was just a chart that looked just like a filter response curve, you know, and that's my hearing. Instead of being flat, it was like had a high-end cutoff and a low-end cutoff, and then they had a line where flat response was. But it seemed like my ear is more of a filter then, and I don't see how multiband would make any difference than a tilt control.
Well, you know, usually as time goes on, most people, everyone, tends to lose their high frequency range to the point where there used to be cell phone applications that kids used at school and other places where they could kind of send signals back and forth to the other kids, but the teacher who had lost their frequency range above 20,000 couldn't hear it at all. So, you know, there tends to be a roll-off. It's much more profound in the high frequency range than the low, just for everyone, but then there are different people with different portions that are kind of knocked out. Not that it filters it, it's that the sensor array in the semicircular canal, where you have these little cilias that are, they start to be long, and then they get shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter, and when you reach kind of resonant for the length of the cilia, it triggers sensory signals to your brain, and that's how, you know, short cilias, you can hear high frequencies, long, you can hear low frequencies, and the high frequencies tend to get damaged, injured, and become more and more insensitive over time. So I think, at least I'm assuming from the way that the software tested my hearing for the Air Pro 2s, that it's a glorified equalizer, that it checks to see see what the threshold of your hearing is at the high end and the low end and maybe the middle, and then tries to kind of adjust the envelope so it adds a little bit of gain at the high end, and it can only, you know, give you so much. And a lot of times, even if you kind of crank it up all the way up, if you have nerve damage enough, you're still not going to hear that well. So, you know, it's an extra use for a product that most people are buying simply because they want to have a nice, you know, in-ear experience with their cell phones or their iPads and such.
It seems to me that the process that they're using must be a lot like tuning filters with multiple coils. And I remember doing this back in the day when we used to tune up these circuits and try to flatten out klystrons and do things like that, and or different bandwidth. And it seemed like if you had the ability, you know, to put up different tent poles at different amplitudes, you could make the response change around all you wanted. And so I think what they're doing with these multi-band systems is just they're just rearranging how they can compensate exactly for your specific case of hearing loss, right? And just by using a multi-band equalizer, like you said. But I think it has more than three tone controls. I think they must have like 32 in the more expensive units, and even more than that.
Again, you have to remember that we're living in the digital times. So there's no real coils, except maybe with the sound emitter. There's a coil there to just move the diaphragm and such. But otherwise, it's all digital signal processing. So it's a digital stream, and there are algorithms that adjust the frequency contours. So, you know, you could have a near infinite number of discrete frequency ranges with adjustable levels. So, you know, that's not a problem anymore. You know, now that most things are solid state, as opposed to the good old days that you actually did have to tune coils and such.
It's really amazing to me that stuff is so little that they can make it and it fits inside of your ear or behind it. It's just an amazing time we're in with the technology, I think.
Yeah, I agree with you entirely. Solid state has made incredible strides. That was kind of a topic I was discussing this Sunday night on the Limewire Technical Net. We had an IT guy who kind of said that it slowed down a lot, so he wasn't impressed. But yeah, yes, it slowed down a lot, but it started ridiculously fast. And I repeated an old story. I still remember I was visiting a computer store when they had stores. And they were selling a hard drive, a box with a hard drive in it for an Amiga computer. It held two entire megabytes of storage capacity, and it only cost $2,000. And you couldn't get a thumb drive these days with 2 megabytes of storage capacity. I think the smallest thumb drive I've seen recently is something like 8 or 12 gigabytes. So the amount of memory at small size, small weight, efficient energy use, and very low price have been miraculous for these many years. It's slowing down, unfortunately, because, you know, Moore's law is not what it used to be, and we're sort of reaching a point of diminishing returns with the technology that's the basis for this stuff. If we shrink things any more than we already have shrunk them, we kind of will start to get problems with dealing with the amount of energy density that produces, and also quantum effects like electron tunneling. If your transistors are small enough, electrons can simply vanish on one side of them and appear on the other side without benefit of how transistors amplify signals. So, it's we live in amazing times, and no doubt there will be improvements, but I don't think the amount of improvements will progress at the rate that they did for the last, say, 20 years.
That's true, but we are getting all kinds of other kinds of improvements. I mean, one of the big improvements would be if they could ever get this stuff to start consuming less power on the AI side with all that processing, because that seems to consume a lot of power. Amazing that this has all come up now during the middle of us trying to convert to clean energy.
call?
Yeah, it's giving these tech bros a big pain in the head because they've made all kinds of promises of being carbon free and such. Because they were dealing with different levels of computation. The Google's search algorithm is child's play next to the amount of number crunching that needs to go on with generative artificial intelligence. And, you know, they expect to, they're very optimistic. I am not as optimistic as they are. They assume that very soon we have general artificial intelligence, which is a significant level above our present type of generative type of, it's a card trick. It's there's no conscious mind behind it. It's a pattern recognition circuit. It has an algorithm and a database, and it's basically trying to predict the probability of what the next, you know, paragraph or page is based upon what question you asked it at the very beginning. So it's, you know, they want generative, they want general artificial intelligence, which is at least an order or two above magnitude above what we're doing now. And then there are some crazy people who think that we'll have a supercomputer who will somehow give us endless resources. I don't know how any computations can create products that we need. You know, there's only so much gold in the world. If everyone wants gold, I don't care how smart the damn supercomputer could be. You can't make gold out of nothing. And, you know, it's not very cost effective to smash it with atoms and just kind of build up smaller atoms into gold atoms and such. But yeah, it's a very big problem. The amount of energy that's required to run the big models, and the bigger the models are, the smarter it tends to be, the faster it tends to be. But it's more expensive to do that. And all these companies are operating at losses. None of them are making a profit off of artificial intelligence. They're just kind of whipping everything up and getting investors to throw billions, if not trillions of dollars at them, with the promise that eventually they will monetize it. And what we should learn from the internet in general is sometimes you can monetize things and sometimes you just can't.
The hardware manufacturers seem to be able to monetize it pretty strong, and their actions seem to keep everyone else in the contrail, if you know what I mean.
Well, it sort of depends what you mean by the hardware manufacturers. The hardware manufacturers for the bleeding edge technology are making a profit, as you can see from the stock market. You know, NVIDIA is particularly making loads and loads of money. But that doesn't strike me as something that's sustainable. You know, you're going to reach a point where you saturate the market, and then the stock price is going to fall over backwards. Plus the fact that NVIDIA pretty much started as a graphic processing unit, game graphics designer and manufacturer. And because they're making so much money selling artificial intelligence hardware, they're screwing up as far as GPUs for game are. They just released their latest 5000 series graphics cards, but they haven't manufactured anywhere near enough cards. So after about a day and a half, the supply ran dry, and it probably won't be filled back up for another month or two. And because of the scarcity, all kinds of people, rather than buying the card and using the card, simply bought it up, and they have it in their closet someplace, and they're going to try and have people pay them, you know, $35, $45, $5500 for basically a $2,000 card. And the idea that a graphics game playing card costs $2,000 strikes me as rather bizarre. I mean, I like games as much as anyone, but, you know, come on, $2,000 for a graphics card? So anyway, some of them are, a lot of them aren't. I wouldn't like to be Intel these days. Intel has been on hard times, and they're a hardware guy company, you know, but they got the wrong hardware. So it depends. A lot of computer hardware are commodities at this point, so there's not a lot of growth in that market.
I agree with a lot of your perspective there. It seems like that's what's going on, but the ones that are making the money are sure making a lot of noise about it.
Well, unfortunately, that's how they continue to make a lot of money. There's a terrible slogan that has taken over Silicon, fake it until you make it. And you've seen it all over the place. The worst example was Theranos, where Elizabeth Holmes, the CEO, was basically lying to everyone. And she was able to build the capital value of Theranos to something like $30 billion before people discovered that it was all smoke and mirrors, and it just became bankrupt overnight.
It's a shame when stuff like that happens. It sort of ruins my faith. You know, I guess we're all sort of gullible, wanting the next best thing and wanting to get in on the ground floor, and then before you know it, the floor falls out.
Well, you know, unfortunately, this has been seen over and over and over and over and over and over and over again with technology, because just because you can theoretically do something doesn't usually mean that you should, because there's not a viable market, or at least in the present day or the present understanding of the technology. And so you had last year, I don't know if you remember, you had a couple of these weird little pendants. That you kind of one you put in your pocket and one you pin to your shirt, and if you put the palm of your hand about 8 feet 8 inches away, it would project a very simple screen, and you could ask it things, and it theoretically would tell you things and schedule things. And none of the scheduling or the telling really worked well, and the display didn't work terribly well. And at least one of the two major companies that presented this as the next great thing has already kind of been bought up by another company that has no interest in continuing a research and development on the device. So most research and development projects fail. Every so often, someone will come over to the Limewire TechNet and, you know, talk about some research development group of people who are, you know, coming up with something that promises to be a breakthrough for fusion power generation. And, you know, I have to play the skeptic and say that, you know, fusion has been predicted as being viable for 20 years in the future. If you ask someone in 1960, they would tell you that at the present rate, it would be ready 20 years from then, so 1980. And if you ask someone today, they'll often tell you it'll be ready in 20 years. So it's just a sliding scale of 20 years. So a lot of things fail. A few things do well, and very few things take off and change the world around us, like, say, the internet. But I remember when it got to the internet, I remember in the 1990s, I used to get these IT newspapers, and they would keep on predicting that that year was the year of the network, and then it wasn't. And the next year was going to be the year of the network. So it dragged out to about 6-7 years until finally it was the year of the network. And with networks, the internet became a much more viable, much more powerful thing, and it changed the world. So even the right idea at the wrong time doesn't work.
Yeah, there were so many factors in all of that. I remember those times well, because there was certain types of networks that won out over other types of networks, and certain types of companies that won out over other companies, and sometimes that was brute force, and sometimes that was technology. It was all a wild, scary ride back then.
Well, it was an unknown land. It was people making up their own rules, because there were no rules, because they were pioneers. IBM, I think, was promoting a coax transmission line-based network solution. Other companies were promoting Ethernet, which finally won out because it's much more scalable and expandable. And of course, you know, not all company can succeed in any given field. There'll be guys who win, and a lot of guys who lose. And even eventually, the winners might turn into losers, and sometimes the losers turn into winners. Again, the primary manufacturer of CPUs. If you talk to anyone about AMD back in the old days, they laughed at you. And, you know, now it's completely different. You want a CPU? AMD AMD has probably the best, design and cost for the product. And Intel is losing money and kind of firing a whole bunch of people and shrinking down. But then AMD used to be pretty good with graphic processing units, game cards. They kind of let themselves, I think they started to focus mostly on CPUs. I think they figured that if they destroyed Intel and took over, that would be more important than competing with other graphic processing companies. So they let NVIDIA take the lead. And, in hindsight, with artificial intelligence, that probably wasn't a good idea on their part.
Thanks a lot for all that commentary. I think I got to go pretty soon. Maybe there's somebody else out there that has got a ham radio question to stump the band.
Okay, William. I'll be happy with any question at this point. I think it's going to be a real quiet night, but we'll see. I continue to be AC2GS. My name is Roy. I'm the control operator for this, the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We're here on the second and fourth Wednesday of every month at 9 p.m., and we go for as long as there's a person out there with either a question or a topic for discussion. So if there's anyone else out there and they'd like to ask a question or bring up a subject, please feel free. Hit that push to talk.
To NVB. Roy, if no one else comes in, I have something I'd like to get your opinion on. Back to you. We can wait and see if someone else comes in.
Yeah, Bob, I don't know. I think it's going to be a real quiet night tonight, so feel free to ask your question.
Okay, I'm going to ask your opinion on this. This is obviously not something you can really likely not answer per se, maybe. Just what do you think? I bought a monitor. I remember I talked to you maybe a month or a little more than a month ago about shopping for a monitor for my, photography, a big. So I got a 27-inch monitor. I got a good monitor, good high-quality monitor. Eizo, I think they call it themselves, EIZO. I got probably one of their lower-end models, but it's, a high-end company. It was like $1,250, and I took your advice. It was not just your advice. I did research in the photography forums, and a lot of photographers recommended just a 2K monitor versus a 4K when you're doing 27 inches, because 4K can actually make everything small and all that. But they're good color gamut. Anyway, I got this this monitor, and I really like the monitor, except for one thing. Possibly, this might be a strange placebo effect, but after buying the monitor, I stumbled on a notice from Eizo, about people have reported some issues when they use Macs with their monitors, because Apple's any M series Mac, which means going back, 6-7 years, can sometimes have flicker issues. And there's some other things they mentioned, like burn-in, which I don't see, but I'm sitting here looking at this monitor, like a white screen, saying, do I have a slight amount of flicker here, or is this just like normal to see that kind of look, especially on a large screen that's a lot of white, like if you have a page that's largely white? And it's doing a head trip on me, and I'm probably going to have to borrow someone's PC laptop just to see if it looks the same with theirs as with mine, because I think I even see it on my MacBook Pro's screen. But the point is, I got about a few more days if I want to return it. And it's frustrating. I really like the monitor otherwise. And maybe there's no problem at all. So anyway, what do you think? Do you look at a largely white screen on a pretty large monitor and you kind of see what some slight variance in the lighting or flicker, or I don't even know if you call it flicker, very mild flicker? Back to you.
Well, I am familiar with Eizo, Japanese monitor manufacturers. Matter of fact, long ago, when all there was were pretty much cathode ray tube monitors, I had an Eizo computer monitor. So they're generally very good quality. They tend to be very visible in the professional sector of monitors, but they have consumer models as well. I don't really have that problem. But it sort of depends on a lot of weird secondary things. The first thing I would suggest to you is you check what your frame rate is with your graphics card. And, you know, maybe it's you're displaying the screen at, 60 frames a second, and if you can set it for a higher refresh rate, that might put the flicker outside of your ability to visualize it. And you might want to think in terms of whether you have any fluorescent lights in the same room. My nephew had this situation once upon a time where his fluorescent lights kind of heterodyned with a flicker of his laptop display, and if you stared at it, you could get a severe headache. You know, he changed the light bulb, so that went away. But I would check the frame rate, and I would also check to see if you have some old CFL, fluorescents hanging out in the fixtures. Anywhere near where you look at the screen. Those would be my two top suggestions. And yeah, sure, I mean, if you have a question or a problem, it's always nice to borrow someone's laptop. Nowadays, laptops have display output connections, so you don't have to lug a desktop to your house.
Right, yeah, I'm going to do that. I'm kind of gnashing my teeth because the day before I had the monitors being delivered, I had a 27-inch iMac that I was using as a monitor because the hard drive had crashed, but I was using it and you can use it in those days with the old Thunderbolt 1 cable with the 2011 iMac with the 2012 MacBook Pro. If I kept the 2012 MacBook Pro, I just got rid of the iMac, this place took it, like recycling, and I just gave them the laptop. If I had just kept the laptop, I could have just tested it with that, the old Mac that has an Intel processor. The issue is not ISO. Their monitors are great. BenQ has the same kind of message. It's a whole lot of non-Apple monitors with Apple computers. One wonders whether it's almost like, if not intentional, Apple's kind of just as happy that it happened because it'll make you buy an Apple monitor. Who knows? But, I've talked to the tech guys at ISO. Very nice. There's like two guys I found out that do the whole, North America or something like that. Nice guys I talked to. I talked to Apple Tech Support. I have some problem because there's a suggestion in this notice. Actually, you cannot raise it past 60 hertz. In fact, they say even their high-end monitors, well, except for the extremely high-end, like that medical people get or something maybe, don't go above 60 hertz. They don't need to, is what this guy said. But they said one suggestion was to lower it to 30 hertz. He says you wouldn't really, he said you might not, you probably wouldn't see it unless you're doing video, and I just do still photography. But I have some weird Apple issues where I can't lower it to 30. It doesn't seem to be an option. It's a long story. There are other little issues I have to hash out with Apple. They have something called Pro, what do they call this thing? Hold on. Anyway, instead of having a refresh rate, they call it ProMotion, where supposedly Apple keeps adjusting the flash, changing the refresh rate, and the guy at ISO said, yeah, that might be some of the problem. But I have problems getting out of it. But I'm not asking you about all that. I have to talk to Apple and these guys about that stuff. But I'm not even sure I see flicker. It's like I say, this could be this sort of a nasty placebo effect. Like, I'm just worried. I'm staring at a white screen. Because I think I even might see it on the Max 16-inch screen. So it's a head trip. That's why I need to borrow a laptop and see if it looks exactly the same with the other laptop that's not an M-Series Mac. I'm just going to keep the monitor. Because if I hadn't read that thing, I might be totally happy with it. So back to you.
Okay. I'm not that familiar with Macs. I mean, my nephew shifted over to them 10 years ago, but I haven't really paid much of attention. Yeah, well, what's going on with Apple is Apple used to use Intel chips as a central processing unit. Before that, they used to use Motorola chips. So, you know, they're not completely loyal. And since Intel was having a lot of problems shrinking their die for many years, eventually Apple got tired of waiting, and they thought that they could set things up and engineer a new CPU chip, the M series, in-house, and have TSMC, the solid state fabricators, just pump out M series chips. So all the all those computers that begin with M are based on a few generations of their M series CPU chips, which are supposedly very, very powerful. But, you know, maybe something doesn't really like to work with each other. I'm a little bit concerned about what these guys at ISO are telling you. I'm starting to sense that maybe, because, you know, they were high-end professional monitors and high-end prosumer monitors 20, 25, 30 years ago. I'm concerned that, you know, maybe when the shift went from CRTs to other technologies, that they pulled something like a Kodak and they kind of fell behind. Because you can buy modern-day computer monitors that have a refresh rate of 240 frames per second. You know, I don't understand the 60 frame per second maximum. I mean, if you're looking at some kind of a medical image, I guess. But if you're looking at computer graphics, video, and all kinds of things blowing up all over the place, most game players would be unhappy if they were stuck at 60. You know, they'll tolerate something in the hundreds, but, you know, 60 is kind of slow for them. So I'm a little concerned of whether ISO is basically pulling a Kodak.
Yeah, I don't know. I get the impression that they out there, I mean, I did a lot of reading and stuff on the internet. ISO, it's, many people are saying ISO is as good as it gets for, I mean, for the kind of stuff, at least for photography and stuff. I mean, they seem to have a very good reputation. And this monitor, like I say, it's a lot of the guys who recommended it are photographers who use Macs. It's not an issue that everybody has. But the 60 hertz thing, I don't know. I mean, I was surprised by that, too. I didn't really know specifically, like you seem to know, but I thought refresh rates get higher than that. Maybe some of their other gaming monitors do higher. I don't know. It is weird. It turns out I can file for a return. I only had like 3 days, but it turns out I called B&H, which is where I bought it. I can tell them I want to return it, like apply for the return, but I'd have 10 days to return and I could change my mind and just keep it. So I got a little more time to borrow a laptop and do a little more reading, and I got to find something I'm going to like as much as this, that if this is flickering, that doesn't flicker. I don't know if Apple makes a monitor on this that specs like this or not, because I don't want 4K. Anyway, I'll just have to read more about it and do the stuff I was just telling you about. So thanks, Roy, for your input. And if you have any more to say, please bring it on. And back to you.
Hey, C2GS. Yeah, I get the sense that they might be riding on their own old reputation. You know, I mean, think in terms of, you know, there was a time that, you know, Kodak was kind of the primary photography company. If you use any others, you know, people would kind of say, yeah, I guess they're okay. And then all of a sudden, the bottom fell out and they were almost gone. You know, they've been bought up and the company, it's a shadow of its former self. I don't know. I mean, like I said, ISO was a very respected brand 25 years ago. There are a lot of very well-made monitors these days. Apple doesn't really offer a lot of options. They kind of have one or two monitors that I've noticed, and they're usually ridiculously overpriced. They once presented a monitor where the stand cost $1,000. So they've gone crazy. As you know, they have such a reputation that they could take a dump and gold plate it and sell it to people for $1,000 at this point. So you know, if you can get a good recommendation foundation of a modern day productive manufacturer that, you know, pumps out a lot and has a good return and warranty and such, you might want to follow them instead of ISO. You know, unless you have a time machine, you can go back 25 years ago when the stuff was great. I don't know. I haven't really looked into ISO lately because they haven't really done anything particularly novel with flat panels. I'm sure they're just buying flat panels from some other manufacturer. And, you know, it's less important, the refresh rate for still images. That's true. But still, you know, I don't know. It's kind of too late in the 21st century to have a monitor that can't go any faster than 60 frames per second. You know, it's kind of like still driving a Model T, which had a great reputation, but, you know, that reputation was what, 1920?
Yeah, I was surprised. I thought maybe maybe a faster refresh rate, correct me if I'm wrong, might be more important on the old CRTs than it is on an LCD. Maybe I'm wrong about that. But I think my old CRT, I had something that was I had a 21-inch CRT starting in 1998 that I had for quite a while until 2008. It was about 10 years. I think it must have had a faster refresh than that, especially since it was 21-inch. But is it true that you can get away with a slower refresh rate on an LCD than you could on a CRT?
In a word, no. It's very difficult to have a particularly fast refresh rate because with CRTs, because CRTs operate with phosphors. Phosphors have a distinct latency period. You know, the image does not appear and disappear instantaneously. So there's a residual. And the more of the residual, the slower the refresh rate. Otherwise, you'll have smearing of the image. So LCDs don't use anything like phosphor. They're instantaneous. They just polarize the liquid crystal display. And as soon as you apply a voltage potential, the polarization angle changes. And there's either light or it's dark or something in between. And that can be modulated ridiculously quickly to the point where modern day LCDs frequently have a refresh rate capability of 240 frames per second. You'd never be able to get a cathode ray tube to refresh anything close to that because of the phosphors.
But weren't they faster than 60? I thought I had an old CRT when my mother, a hand-me-down 386 from my mom. This is back when I first got into computing. I was a little late in the game, like early 90s, and it was a 386 when she got a 486, and that thing really flickered, and I think it damaged my eyes using that thing. That was when I was into coding, and I was spending way too much time staring at the thing, but it was like 50 or 60, and I thought, not 240, but didn't they get faster than 60?
I think they went all the way up to 85, and I think that was about it. I think you could get maybe a little bit higher for specialty cases, but they never got over 100.
All right, so, but it, with the same refresh rate on a CRT, would it look like more flickery or problematic than on a LCD, like if they were both 60, for example?
Yeah, you would get less flicker because of the persistence of the phosphors, but you would get more smearing.
So it'd be kind of equally bad in different ways.
Yeah, that's usually how things work out.
Well, so you don't notice when you stare at especially a large display of a white screen, something that you could think might be flicker, irregular. Like, or as far as light bulbs, every light bulb I have in the house is now LCD, so I guess it's not that.
Okay, but sometimes when you describe it, you say it isn't really flicker. I'm looking at a website that's white background. So very little text that's black, but the rest of it is white, and I don't have any flicker. It's a Dell monitor that I'm looking at it on. I like Dells, and they have good warranties. I had a big center Dell monitor that failed before the warranty expired, and I wrote them, and they just sent me a brand new one. So I'm happy with Dell. I don't know how fast the refresh rate is because I don't play that many games. So, you know, I can't tell you exactly what refresh rate I'm setting these things at. But I'm sure they go faster than 60 if I wanted to.
Look into it. So I don't know if they'll make something like the other one. This actually monitor is excellent. I mean, the screen, the colors, the regularity, it's all really great. I really like it. Other than this possible issue, it's just very weird and frustrating.
Yeah, well, I don't know exactly what to tell you. Yeah, I'm trying to see if it's coming out. Your mileage might vary. You know, it's kind of surprising that the guys who kind of have the same thing that you have don't have any problems. But you know, that's why technology is such a pain in the backside sometimes.
Yes, computer technology. I mean, I read this 30 years ago, and it makes sense. Computers are, that computing and all that is about the most complicated man-made thing in existence. There's so much complexity, so there's so many things that can go weird and seem inexplicable. So this Dell Omega monitor, that's like pretty high quality. I mean, this monitor was, you know, it's, I don't know if the price tells you much, but I paid $1,250, and that's was one of their lower end, might be their cheapest $27. Just because it's not 4K, but it has a good, they say it has a great color gamut, it looks good to me. It has all these different options for color, profiles, all that kind of business. But does Dell make anything like that, or that would be maybe equivalent to that?
Well, I don't know exactly. They have a lot of monitors, so it's not like Apple, where if you look it up, I think at best you'll find two monitors. They probably have something like 30 or 40 different monitors, all different sizes. Really big, really ridiculously big ones, and regular smaller size ones. Look at the specs. They usually kind of explain the range of the color gamuts that the display is capable of. They might even give you a little display of it and such. And I'm sure there's a file that you can plug in to places like Photoshop and everything else that will kind of adjust for the specced out gamuts for any particular display technology and model and make and such. So as far as I am aware, they make high-quality consumer monitors for business and for games, which can really require you to have a well-designed electronics. So I'm not 100% sure if they have a prosumer for, I would assume they would have something that comes very close to that, if not that identical. Because they sell a lot of monitors.
Right, I'll have to do more research. People mention NEC and they mention ISO as some of the best, you know, these photographers. BenQ is another one, and BenQ also has a similar notice. Thing about this Apple issue, it may be affecting Dell monitors also. It's just all sorts of non-Apple monitors, supposedly. Back to you.
Well, I mean, then you tend to have a bit of a problem, again, because, I mean, Apple has high-quality monitors, but you pay through you know, you pay a lot. So I'm sure it's, you know, unless there's some kind of incompatibility issue, I'm sure it's money wasted, because there's only so good a monitor can be. You know, I think they were selling one for about, I don't know, $6,000, something semi-ridiculous. It's very possible that if the M chip is doing strange things, and Apple certainly has no vested interest in telling you that you could go buy a competitor for a lot less money, that all the powers that be will kind of point you towards the Apple store. But again, it greatly limits, I think there's only two present-day models that they sell, and they're both overpriced. So, you know, if you want to be safe rather than sorry, I guess that's a possibility. But again, I would kind of talk to the guys and see if they've had any consistent positives with a certain brand. Now, when you mention NEC, again, it's sort of, NEC is like ISO. These were guys who were big into the professional broadcast monitor environment, and they sold models to consumers on a kind of secondary type of level. So, but they haven't, again, done anything, as far as I'm aware, innovative in 25 years, ever since the cathode ray tubes kind of faded away. So, again, I think a lot of this is past glory. I might be wrong, but it seems rather weird that these companies have sort of become niche for you know, broadcasters, and not even that much for broadcasters, because I think most of the time when I hear people talking about broadcast monitors, a lot more times they're talking about Sony. Sony is kind of staying with state of the art. And again, I think NEC probably buys their flat screen from Korea or from China. I don't know exactly where, but I don't think they're building their own flat screens. So again, I think it's past glory, perhaps.
Well, if I take this monitor back, maybe I should look into Sony monitors. They probably make monitors for photographers, wouldn't you think?
Yeah, I can't recall, because, again, I've heard people talk about their broadcast monitors. They have consumer TV sets. I don't recall them. I don't think they've been really promoting anything for computer monitors. They sort of went out of the computer business 15, 20 years ago. You know, they used to sell desktops. They used to sell laptops. And I guess they the problem with computers is they've become mostly commodities. So it's difficult to kind of extract a nice profit unless you're Apple.
Yeah, the only thing I'm thinking is they now, as you know, you have one yourself, one of the major camera brands, including a lot of the stuff I'm getting into right now. I just bought another lens for bird photography, and of course Sony, Nikon, and Canon are often the ones. I got an OM system, which is that 4/3 sensor. And it can be smaller, lighter. I have to pay some price with the smaller sensor, of course. But anyway, getting back to, like, Sony makes major cameras and lenses and stuff for that, for, you know, major photography. So if they made monitors at all for people, they might make some photographer monitors.
Yeah, I did a quick little Googling, and they're still manufacturing and selling computer monitors. Most of them they kind of promote as gaming monitors, so I know that are designed for a wider gamut or more accurate color display, kind of meant for, you know, prosumer, a photography type of thing. But, you know, it's a Google away, and again, they're keeping up with the technology. I mean, unfortunately, some of their technology is bought from others. You know, back in the good old days, what made Sony great, among other things, were Trinitron CRT tubes, and those have gone the way of all things. You know, no one does tubes anymore, so the Trinitron technology is worthless to them. So they too end up buying panels from places like Samsung or LG or what have you. And but I tend to think that they're still kind of proud of their technology, that they put a lot into research and development with the other parts of the circuitry of monitors other than just the display screen itself. So, you know, I would sooner consider investing in a Sony than an Ezo or an NEC. You know, unless, of course, it was 1995. Then I'd say, yeah, sure, wonderful companies.
Yeah, I have to do more research. So, although I'll say I really use photography forums, and there's ISO, and it's a little thing mentioned. A lot of people like them. And there's BenQ also, which also has a notice about the same kind of issues with Apple computers. I'll have to do more reading and thinking in the next week to 10 days, which is what I have to decide on this issue.
Okay. I wish you good luck, and I hope you figure out something that works for you. I tell you, when my nephew kind of showed me his laptop screen, I was amazed by what a fluorescent light bulb above in the ceiling could possibly do to a person. If I had to do any kind of significant work under his environment, my brain would probably explode, or at least my eyeballs would bleed.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to be under fluorescent lights for anything. I just don't like them at all. Going to places that have those things, I just don't like them.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, at the time they had their place. I still have one fluorescent light in this house. It's in the kitchen, where it was very, very common to have one of those circular fluorescent tubes.
Yeah, I've been in kitchens. I can tolerate that, just going in the kitchen. But I wonder if we should check, see if possibly is there anybody out there? Some other questions?
Okay, we're probably coming towards the end of tonight's net, but nevertheless, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We're still open for business. If anyone has any questions or comments or topics for discussion, then hit that push to talk and tell us. That's a lot of noise. I can't make you out. You know, I could guess who it might be, but it's approximately, I'd say, about 93% noise and 7% voice. Okay, I thought it was you, Andy, but I sometimes, if I recognize the person gets a little bit annoyed at me. So, Andy, I don't know what to tell you. I can barely make you out. Fortunately, I got HUH out of that string of noise. So it's getting into the repeater is probably not great tonight. I don't know what to tell you, Andy. I mean, if you're really curious, if you're able to kind of get internet access, I mean, just kind of go to the audio streaming on our site and listen to what the audio sounds like from my side. It's really noisy. I mean, I can pick out the words and I can string them together and can kind of fill them around better now than I could a couple of minutes ago, but it's real noisy. Yeah, I don't know what to tell you. I mean, you know, maybe it's just a kind of some freaky little situation with propagation tonight, and hopefully other nights will be much better. I mean, worst comes to worst, consider availing yourself of our EchoLink access. That usually is very good.
Oh, by the way, I'm going right I'm on the output of the repeater right now, actually. 146.73. So that's the repeater frequency is 146.73.
Yeah. By the way, this past transmission was much better than the first few. So I don't know if you moved your handy talkie or what you did or something, but it sounds a lot better now. But yeah, the proper input is 146.130. So you're transmitting on the output frequency.
Well, that's why I'm not going through the repeater. I'm going direct. On this frequency, I'm transmitting on 146.73, 100 watts on my actually that's the antenna that Eugene gave me.
Okay, well, you can continue doing it this way, because like I said, now I can hear you. When you first transmitted, were you on the input or the output?
I was transmitting before. I was going through the repeater.
Okay, well, probably there's something wrong with the propagation from your shack to the repeater. From your shack to my shack, it's fine. Like I said, I hear you fine now. But when you're talking through the repeater, it was just, it didn't pick it up. It was losing you all over the place. So, you know, the repeater is, you know, off to the, still on my edge of the Long Island. So, you know, maybe there's something a little wonky going on with that.
Obviously, I don't need a repeater. But isn't that funny how I always say I get a hard way to go no matter what I do. The repeater don't like me. But anyway, I just wanted to let you know that the that AL80 AE amplifier is rated to draw 12 amps. And that's exactly what I read for the most part with my watt meter. I was drawing 1,500 watts. And the other amplifier with the twin tube is supposed to draw on 120 volts. It's supposed to draw actually 20 amps. They want you to use a 10 gauge wire AC line with a 30 amp fuse/breaker on it. So I'm not even going to be bothered. I mean, I always knew I could not use get full output out of that amplifier with 120 volts, and I wasn't wrong. Without reading anything, I always knew that just by knowledge, skill, and experience. But after I read it, I said, okay, I'll put this away. And that's it. So I just thought I'd let you know. And what do you think?
Well, it certainly does make sense. You know, I mean, unfortunately, that's the reason why people spend a lot of money hiring electricians or doing it them faster and putting together dedicated, you know, 220, 240 volt lines. You know, you can't, you know, you're not going to, you would have to rewire your house or risk an electrical fire if you just kind of took the 15 amp fuse out of the line and replaced it with a 20 or 25 amp fuse. So, you know, I mean, that, again, you know, you can't break the laws of physics in something. All of our electrical circuits are sort of designed to carry a maximum of 15 amps. There's a reason for that. So because of the amount of copper that's used. If you wanted to have a custom designed house with a lot more copper, it would cost you more, but you would be able to have higher current breakers. I don't know if the electrical code allows for that. It might, but you have to do something special. So yeah, that's the problem with a lot of these vacuum tubes. So supposedly it's about 70% efficiency, which is pretty good for a vacuum tube. I would have placed it at less, but that's another problem. Vacuum tubes are just inherently less efficient than solid-state amplifiers.
Yes, okay, very good. Well, I'll leave that issue alone then. I'll leave the amp alone and until I can somehow get 20, the 220 in here. And I wouldn't even bother with a dedicated 120 line with that large gauge wire. But yeah, I'll get the 220 in here one day. And all right, so I just thought I'd let you know. This way you have that confirmation, because you were pretty much on the mark there when you had mentioned a couple of those specs. All right, then I'll give it back to you. I won't belabor the point, and until next time, take it light, and best 73 from Handy Andy N2HUH.
Okay, very good, Andy. It would be cost effective if you were going to have a new dedicated line put in, to have a 220 or 240 put in rather than a 120, because you know most power guzzlers can be configured to 240, and the cost of the copper for the wire has to be significantly less to run a 240 line than to run a 120 line for the same amount of power output. So it's certainly, if you were going to invest, I would say invest in a 240 dedicated line, not a 120.
Very good. So we'll leave it at that. I agree. I concur. Until next time, take it light. Back to you, N2HUH.
Okay, very good, Andy, 73. I'll repeat an old story that I may or may not have mentioned in these technical nets. Way back in the good old days when I was an intern and a resident at a hospital, the chief of medicine, chiefs of medicine, they try to minimize how much work they do. So the intern and the resident would take the history and do the physical for the patient and write up a long-winded story in the hospital chart, and he would come by and he would write right underneath it, "I concur," and then he signed it. And every so often we would have some guy who came from another country, a resident or an intern. I think the guy was Egyptian. And he knew English, but, you know, he wasn't really proficient. So, I mean, he looked at it and he frowned and he said, "What the hell does concur mean?" I think you switched back to the input frequency, right, Andy?
Yeah, I thought by turning the radio on and off, it would have made a difference, but it didn't. So, yeah, but I'm glad you told me that story. I'm glad you did. Very good.
Okay, very good, Andy. Thanks for coming. Thanks for participating. It kind of gets lonely here every so often, so I thank you very much. Once again, I continue to be AC2GS. My name is Roy. I'm the net control operator for the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We meet on the second and fourth Wednesday at 9 p.m., and we go on for as long as anyone has any questions or comments or topics for discussion. So it's up to you guys out there. If anyone has any further questions or comments or topics, topics, please hit that push to talk and tell me what they are.
Leroy, this is KT2VEA.
Yes, hello, Maxim. I see you on the Echo Link window.
I was monitoring and listening to your discussion while you were guys were talking about monitors and such, and I have a couple of comments. First one, Bob, is that if you're getting it from B&H, there's have a bunch of people there who are very knowledgeable about this. Just go talk to them and tell them about this problem. They probably would have heard about it and would know who complained about the M-chips. I have a Mac laptop as well, and for some docks, it just flickers. It just turns on and off. Not flickers like you can't quite perceive it flickers, but like actually turns off, turns on. Apparently, there's a glitch in the implementation of the hardware in the Mac display, whatever it is, hardware. But I would say just go talk to the B&H people. They'll probably tell you.
Max, this is K2NVB. Did you say this display, is this a display, like do you have a laptop? Is it the laptop screen or the built-in screen of your, I don't know if you have an iMac, a laptop, or is this an external monitor you're talking about? And if so, is it an Apple monitor? Back to you.
I have a MacBook Pro with the M chip, and you know the monitor that's built into the laptop works perfectly fine. It's when I connect it to a dock that has two regular monitors connected, which we use just for office work. They just turn on and off, like they don't flicker. They just like every so often one of the monitors just turns on and off, and it's something about the two display ports and how it splits and how it interacts through a Thunderbolt cable. And I read up about it, but like Apple refuses to fix it. So it's kind of a different problem than from yours, I feel, but I do think like if you go to B&H and just you know go to the store and go to like to the counter that they talk for the displays and just talk to them about it, they're usually pretty good about it.
Yeah, I'm gonna call somebody on the phone tomorrow. I called a guy today about the return because my return window it ends Friday, but he said you can file for a return, and you have 10 days to return it, which means I could also change my mind and not return it. So I actually kind of, as long as I file it, if I have any doubts, I really have another 10 days. I'm going to wait till Friday to do it, so then I'll kind of 12 days from now. But, when I was in the store because I bought a lens, and so while I was at it, I went and bought the lens rather than ordering it because I wanted to go in. And one guy I just talked to, standing next to the display, said, "Oh, ISO's the best." And he's just trying to keep my monitor or something. But it might be a similar issue because it just seems like from what I've been reading on the internet, supposedly these complaints have come in now and then for a few years. Any M-chip Mac, which means, I don't know, going back how far, 6, 7, 8 years, I don't know, a lot. And one person said, I don't know if it's how accurate it is, that Apple refuses to acknowledge that there's a problem. So that's the kind of thing I've been reading about. Anyway, back to you. Thanks for the info, though.
Sure, no problem. The other question I have, right, it was interesting, the transmission from the other station in the beginning, it didn't sound like just regular what you would hear, just a noise, like where the transmission's not reaching. It was like, it almost felt like it was like something was interfering. It was like up and down. Weird waveform on top of it. Did you hear that?
Yeah, there's a lot of static. Usually with bad signals, the sound quality of the noise is a little bit more diffuse. But this had, and also I look at the recording sound envelopes, and so his audio kept on having these little very short time interval spikes. So it was a kind of a staticky noise as opposed to the usual kind of broad frequency noise of a low power reception.
I noticed it was kind of interesting. Lastly, we'll talk about it during our meeting, but I just wanted to give you a heads up. So Frank said that one of his locations, the storefront, is open and it's empty until May. So if we wanted to do a technical session, like, you know, soldering, putting something together, we may be able to do that at there. So we'll discuss it, but I just want to give you a heads up because the question is, if we are going to have a space to do a technical session, what do we want to do? Do we want to get some radio kits to solder? Do we want to just bring your equipment and test out? Like, do we want to do a session on how to test your antenna with a nano VNA? I mean, that's the things I came up with, like, thinking about it, but I just wanted to see what thoughts you have and give you a little bit of time to think about it before I put you on the spot in about a week.
Okay. We'll talk about it more in a week. The problem with some of those things is location is really important. So sweeping an antenna in an enclosed area that's shielded it might give you interesting information. You can't really apply it for actual operation, and take the antenna outside in a completely different environment and assume that all the things that were resonant inside the room are going to be resonant outside. But we could do things like that. We could do how do you put connectors on? How you solder? How do you check for cold solder joints? How to use a different test equipment? The VNA, just in general, spectrum analyzer, a bunch of different things. But I'll put up a little list someplace, and we'll talk about it next week.
That'd be awesome. There's another thing I was thinking about, and this will be some dollars. There are different outfits that sell kits, either put together, like a radio, or put together a Morse code paddle and those kind of things like that. That if we really wanted to, we could try that as well. I think I still have somewhere a little kit sending around for like putting together a Morse code paddle for 20 meters, I think. But anyways, so stuff like that. We could also do a kit, and that will be part put together radio part. Learn how to solder.
Yeah, AC2GS, by the way. That's another good idea. The only problem with those types of things is you pretty much have to figure out how many people are going to show up. Just make sure that you have enough. And, unfortunately, if kind of everyone says they're sort of going to come and three people come and you bought, 12 kits or something. But there's all kinds of nice little really low-cost. There are QRP, Morse code transmitters. There are little receivers. There are all kinds of little fun things. Unfortunately, most of those things these days are built and manufactured in China. I don't know exactly what the importation is going to look like in a month or so, but that's another option as well. Yeah, sure.
Well, we'll see how it goes. This is KD2VEA. We'll chat about it more in our monthly meeting, but I wanted to pick your brain now and give you a little bit of heads up. I'm glad you already know about it. Cool. I think that's all the questions I had. And I already told you that the presentation for FT8 is going to be moved by a month, which I was excited about the presentation, but April might be a better timing anyways because I have to go outside to do FT8 and it's still pretty damn cold.
Okay. That'll be interesting. We had some kind of light preliminary during the pre-meeting last month, so it'll be more of that. So looking forward to that. We'll see how things go. Okay. Thank you, Max. I hope we have a big turnout for our meeting coming up, even without the presentation. We'll see how things go. Thank you very much.
Appreciate it, Reb. Have a good night, and we'll talk soon.
Okie dokie. Once again, I continue to be AC2GS. My name is Roy. I'm the control operator for this, the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. And, usually around this time, we kind of run out of fuel. But it's up to you people out there. If anyone is still listening and has a question or a comment or a topic for discussion, I'm more than happy to entertain it. It's the ball is in your court, as the saying goes.
PP with a very quick one. Also, a little signal report. Occasionally, during your transmissions throughout the whole net, there's a weird ka-chunk drop out in the middle of your sentence and a couple syllables get lost, and you come back. Another thing was that Andy, of course, I heard that same really bad noise that his signal was, but it seems like I got it even worse than you because you were having conversation with him, and I couldn't copy much at all from him except an occasional word. So obviously, you were receiving him better than me. So I'm just feeding you some data you can think about. Back to you. But I do have this one little question about my laptops in general. It seems like I just leave it plugged in, like the little, on Mac they have that little magnetic thing, you just pop on and off. But I'm wondering if that's probably not the best way to make for your battery life. Is it better to let the thing drain about halfway and then plug it back in or something similar to that? Back to you. call?
Yeah, we sort of had a similar conversation like this about a year or two ago. It sort of depends upon the technology of your laptop. I have Lenovo's. Lenovo's have multiple batteries, so you can set the batteries to not fully charge. You can set them to partially charge. So my laptops are always about 3/4 charge. And when it gets to 3/4, it stops. So I would suggest something along those lines, assuming that your laptop is capable of that setting.
Oh, great. Thanks for that idea. I've been calling Apple Tech Support about other things. I'll mention that to them, or I'll find out online, Googling, whatever, if I can do that. But if not, if there's no automatic way, is it best to kind of let the thing, I don't know, guess sort of keep an eye on. It's just easy to leave it plugged in, but it's probably not the best thing for the battery to have it always hovering at 100%. So maybe let it go down to 75 or charge or go further and come up to 75. I don't know. I'll Google this and I'll talk to Apple about it.
Yeah, Apple tends to think about these things. They might not make it easy. They probably call it something like energy savings, power savings, conservation mode, what have you. That effectively does the same thing that my Lenovo does to just kind of limit the maximum amount of stored energy to less than 100%. If you do it manually, theoretically, you can do it. In practical terms, it would probably give me a major headache, and I probably would start forgetting to do it and leave it plugged in because it's much more convenient that way. But unless it's a very, very old laptop, it probably has a power saver setting that if all you have to do is find it and enable it, and it should kind of do that.
Yeah, likely so. This is a new laptop. I mean, I bought it. That's the thing. I bought it in the end of, it was over Thanksgiving Black Friday sale. It turns out it's about a little more than a year old model. It was sitting in the store, I guess. It's an M3 when the M4s are the newest. But it's a pretty new machine. And the point is, I've only had it for, what, less than four months or less. So, yeah, it's a new machine. And, yeah, you're right. I think they might have a power saving. They supposedly had one on the phone, but I thought I set it, but it didn't work. So I just manually charged my phone. I see it get down to 20, and I try to catch it and charge it up to 80. And I've gotten good at knowing how many minutes that is, so I set the alarm, and it works. But, yeah, it's a little different than the laptop. And maybe they'll tell me how to actually set the automatic thing. I thought I figured it out, but it didn't work. I probably was doing something wrong. So I'll talk to Apple about this. Thanks, Roy. Back to you. And that signal report, that was a little weird where you had these occasional dropouts and the fact that I couldn't hear Andy as well as you could.
Well, again, who knows what's going on? I mean, again, it could be simply that I need to reboot the computer, that every so often the CPU is off with other processes. I'm running at around 78% CPU activity, which is a lot considering that this is an i9 with something like 16 cores. But, you know, again, good old Windows. What can I tell you?
Right. Okay, yeah, I guess that's it. Yeah, it just sounded like a kerchunk, you know, like the problems we used to have when I had that bad microphone connection. And then you lose about 2 syllables and then you're back.
Okay. I mean, you know, we had that terrible problem with the distortion, and basically the solution to that was just to reboot the computer. I mean, I had to kind of restart Echo Link right before the net. It seemed to work. It changed the drivers in the last 2 hours, so I changed them back, and I was able to make a connection with my other Echo Link application on my internal network. But when I tried to transmit, the audio didn't get to the Echo Link, so I had to quit Echo Link and then start it again, and then it worked. So who knows? You know, computers are kind of wacky that way, especially Windows. You know, sometimes you start it up again, and for some odd reason, the programs don't launch in the right order, and they don't pull the resources in the right order, and things act weird, and you just reboot them again, and then things work fine. So, what can I tell you? I wish there was a simple solution to this. Probably if I got some system that ran on Unix, it would be a lot more bulletproof.
Yes. In a perfect world, we could avoid Microsoft's issues and Apple's issues or practices and just run Linux. But then there's the other thing with all those companies, like I want to run Adobe Lightroom. They won't play ball with Linux. They won't make a Linux version of their program and, you know, all that kind of stuff. Yes, back to you.
Trying to make contact here with the call sign is KD2BBN. Can anyone hear me?
Yes, I hear you. I'm AC2GS.
That's fantastic. I was listening a little bit late on the TechNet and just wanted to say hi.
Oh, okay. Hi, back. We're here on the second and fourth Wednesday of each and every month. It starts at 9 p.m. and it goes for as long as anyone has any kind of question for us.
Well, that sounds fantastic. I'll try and listen again on the next one and put together some questions.
Okay, very good. Glad to hear you, and I look forward to your questions next time. Not quite sure what's happening, but that was all static, unfortunately. Anyway, Bob, I think we had a pretty good net tonight, and we'll see what the future brings.
A2NVB, that sounds good to me, Roy. Yes, yes, I think it's that time. I'm getting a little tired myself, so I guess we're all going to say 73 now. Back to you.
Yes, indeed. That's the plan. In the very old days, Dick A2RIW on the Limewark Technical Net didn't really have a hard cutoff time. He kind of had the same philosophy that if anyone wanted to ask him anything, he would stay around. And it got to be somewhat ridiculous for him. You know, I mean, he was in his 70s, and the net was going on until 1, 2 o'clock in the morning. So finally, he had a chat with the guys running the repeater and said, you know, wouldn't it be a real nice time at 12 midnight to do a maintenance shutdown of the repeater? And so you know, the Limewark TechNet went to shutting down at 12 o'clock, and then a couple of years later, it was decided to shut it down at the TechNet at 11 p.m., and that's what we do these days. So, you know, some of the old-timers could go all night long.
Because I guess he had trouble saying no, you know, to the people could, you know, answer the next question. But I remember when I went on in 2017 when I first became a ham, and it was like till midnight, and then I remember they went to 11. I think that was just in the last few months of his life when he was probably, you know, his health was probably getting to him, and that's my guess. So he was getting more tired and needed to take it more easy. Yeah, back to you.
Yeah, I you know, it was a combination of things. You know, the amount of participants. I mean, if you take a Wesley away from the technical net, sometimes there's no questions. And then people get very upset that I talk to Wesley, and I keep on telling them, well, why don't you do something? Why don't you ask questions? Why don't you transmit? You know, this is not an entertainment show. And, you know, I don't, you know, since it's not visual, I don't get to shrug. But I assume on the other end of the radio is a guy shrugging at me.
Right. Well, I'm guilty of listening to your nets a lot and rarely coming in, but if I had something to contribute, I would. Usually I'm just listening and it's, I don't know, it's just not something I'm versed in or whatever, but yeah, at least I'm listening to it a lot, and so anyway, back to you. It's always good to hear you on these nets, whether I'm talking or not.
Okay, ultimately, I appreciate people who listen as well. Doesn't really kind of feed into the flow of the particular net, but, you know, I bumped into more than a few people who recognize my voice. And they say, oh, yeah, I listen. I don't talk, but I listen. So it's okay. Anyway, thanks as always, Bob. We'll talk again soon. And my next transmission will be the closer.
Out. I don't know if you hear me. I tried getting in Dublin a couple of times. It didn't work, but Hopefully you get me now. Thanks a lot for the TechNet tonight, Roy, 73.
You're welcome, William. Yeah, at first you doubled half of you, the first half of you with Bob, and I could hear Bob, but I couldn't hear you. But then after he unkeyed, I could hear you. So thank you. I appreciate it.
I really enjoy your perspective, and thank you so much for doing this. I mean, it makes it really fun for me. I don't look at it so much as entertainment, but I think of it as educational.
Okay, you know, I mean, it's, you know, one could be the other. It depends. I mean, even if it's educational, if it's not presented, in my opinion, in a in an entertaining type of a way, it could, even useful facts, if they're droned on rather dryly, can kind of bounce off people's heads. So, entertainment is not inherently empty stuff. It's the envelope that you select to present the information that sometimes determines whether people will absorb it or let it bounce off them.
I really enjoy your style, so let's say it that. Thanks a lot for doing the TechNet. I really enjoy it, and I certainly hope we can encourage more people to dial in and, you know, maybe if not have any questions, but to listen and let you know that they're listening. That would be great if somebody out there that's listening would let Roy know.
Well, I kind of model this over after the Limewire Technical Net, and after I think about 39 years, Dick I'd have added to his intro to for people please not to check in to his net because after 40 years he knows people are listening type of thing, and I don't want it to kind of turn into a check-in net. There's a net on HF called East Cars, which is basically a bunch of guys in cars who have HF radios, who check in, announce who they are, and then the next guy checks in, and the next guy checks in, and it's just like someone who's reading from a telephone book. So all things equal, you know, I don't mind if people don't particularly check into the technical net. It's the questions and the comments and the topics that are the kind of grist for the mill. That I don't think anyone wants me to do monologue presentations here. And I think it's better to kind of bounce off of people's questions and comments because at least there's one person who's interested in an answer for that particular subject.
I really think that's a great format. We should make an AM radio station go nationwide, but I guess that won't happen. Anyway, it's really wonderful listening to you, and thanks a lot for doing the TechNet.
You're welcome. Thank you for participating. I really do appreciate it, William. You're one of our regulars here. I depend on you.
Not always that reliable, but I do try. Thanks a lot.
Okie doke, this net has been brought to you by the Kings County Radio Club. Our club is an ARRL-affiliated club based in Brooklyn, New York, and we meet on the first Wednesday of each and every month. Our next meeting will be March 5th, which will be a virtual meeting using Zoom software. Club members will be emailed with the details of the meeting. Non-members wishing to join a general club meeting can email me, AC2GS, with some form of identification for the required link. Although our meetings informally begin after 7 p.m., our formal regular general meeting starts at 8 p.m. and continues until anywhere from 9 p.m. to 10 p.m., depending upon the number of points that are covered. We have a weekly 2-meter club net on every Tuesday night at 9 p.m. on this repeater. This technical net meets on the second and fourth Wednesday of each month at 9 p.m., and we also sponsor a 10-meter net every Sunday morning at 11 a.m. on 28.380 megahertz upper sideband or nearby. Sometimes that frequency is in use or there's noise, so we move a little bit to the right or the left. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club, and as always, an application is readily available on our club's website. Let me have a drink. If you would like to contact the hosts of this technical net, simply address your email to tech@kc2rc.com. We maintain an app at www.kingscountyradioclub.com or www.kc2rc.com, which offers archives of this technical net, amateur radio news, original articles, and technical forums. Please visit our website and participate. Our website hosting services were generously donated by the local Brooklyn-based web hosting company, Three Aliens Web Hosting, who we would like to thank. As the great philosopher whatever Jimi Hendrix once said, knowledge speaks, but wisdom listens. So try to listen a bit more and talk a bit less. Time to roll this all up and shut it all down, but we'll be back March 12th to do it all over again. So thanks to everyone who participated tonight, and especially my co-host, Bob, KD2NVB. Without you guys, I'd just be talking to myself. So this is Roy AC2GS going clear and getting the heck out of here. Stay safe, be well, and we'll talk to you down the line. This is AC2GS clear.